Chapter 6. Mismanaged Democracy. The turmoil of 1993 deepened Sobchak's dependence on Putin and his trust in him. The newspaper Kommersant described Putin as a man as close to Sobchak as Prince Menshikov was to Peter the Great, referring to the man who was the Tsar's commander and confidant in the 18th century until he was exiled to Siberia after Peter's death. Putin, Sobchak said, was a courageous and decisive person, without designs on Sobchak's authority or even on his position. As a result, he drew his deputy deeper into the city's management, not just in the field of foreign investment, but also into his fights against critics and prosecutors who began inquiries into Sobchak's financial affairs. In the fall of 1993, Sobchak asked Putin to manage the parliamentary campaign of Russia's Choice, a party created by Yeltsin's on-again, off-again Prime Minister, Yegor Gaidar. It was a puzzling order, since Sobchak had created his own bloc, the Russian Movement for Democratic Reform, which failed spectacularly to win any seats when the vote was held in December. But Putin never questioned orders. He stood resolutely behind Sobchak, as loyal to his boss as he had been to his superiors in the KGB, even when it blinded him to their shortcomings. Putin worked tirelessly, with an obsession that seemed at times to inure him to hardship and tragedy, even those close to home. On the morning of October 23, 2003, Putin drove his daughter Masha to school and then headed to the Astoria Hotel, where Sobchak had a special assignment for him. Lyudmila stayed at home with a feverish Katya, then 7. Katya pestered her mother to let her go to school anyway to rehearse her part in a play. She was going to be Cinderella, and though Lyudmila thought better of it, the girl insisted. She drove a new Jiguli, which, though modest, was the family's second car and a sign of rising prosperity. Just before noon, as Lyudmila neared a bridge that crosses the Neva, another car sped through a red light and smashed into the Jiguli. The impact knocked Lyudmila unconscious. When she woke, she thought she could keep driving, but found she could not. Katya, who had been asleep in the back, was bruised, though not badly hurt. Then, for a long time, nothing happened. The police arrived and bystanders gathered, but it took an ambulance 45 minutes to arrive. Such was the decrepit state of basic services. A woman whose name and number Lyudmila later lost called the ambulance and a number that Lyudmila dictated to her. Putin's secretary, Marina Yentaltseva, answered but was unsure what to do. Putin's trusted aide, Igor Sechin, went to the crash site and brought Katya to the office at Smolny. Yentaltseva went to find Putin. The ambulance finally arrived and took Lyudmila to the October 25th hospital, still named in honor of the first day, on the old calendar, of the Bolshevik Revolution. "The hospital was horrible," she recalled later. "It was full of people who were dying. There were gurneys in the hallway with dead bodies on them. Worse, the doctors who treated her did not notice that she had broken 3 vertebrae in her spine and fractured the base of her skull. The surgeon sutured her torn ear and left her naked on the table in freezing operating rooms in a terrible state of half-consciousness." During all this, Putin was meeting at the Astoria with the American cable television executive Ted Turner and Jane Fonda, then his wife. They were in Petersburg to arrange the staging of the 3rd Goodwill Games, the international sporting competition Turner dreamed up after the 1980 Olympics in Moscow were boycotted by the United States and other countries following the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and the 1984 Olympics were boycotted in retaliation by the Soviet Union and most of its satellites. The first games had been held in Moscow in 1986, the second in Seattle in 1990. Turner wanted to return them to the new Russia in 1994, and Sobchak was eager to showcase the city, even if it could ill afford the necessary investments. Putin was shepherding the couple to a series of meetings when his secretary finally reached him at the hotel. He slipped out to go to the emergency room. "Don't worry, she's not in any danger," the chief surgeon there told him. "We're just going to put a splint on and everything will be fine." "Are you sure?" he asked. Absolutely, the surgeon replied, and without seeing his wife, Putin returned to his meetings. Meanwhile, Yentaltseva took Katya to a hospital and picked up Masha from school. Putin asked that Yentaltseva spend the night with them at the family's dacha. He also asked her to call Yuri Shevchenko, one of the city's most prominent physicians at the Military Medical Academy, who would later be a minister of health. It was evening before she finally reached Shevchenko, and he immediately sent a doctor from the academy's clinic. Lyudmila remembered waking in the operating room and feeling his warm hand holding hers. It warmed me up, and I knew that I had been saved. The doctor arranged her transfer to the military hospital, and an X-ray discovered spinal injuries that required emergency surgery. That night, between meetings, Putin visited her for the first time, meeting Yentaltseva and his children in the parking lot. He told her it was unlikely he would make it home because his discussions with Ted Turner were scheduled to continue into the night. She took the girls to the dacha and, unable to find the switch for the heat, huddled them in one bed with extra blankets. She was startled awake when Putin arrived home at 3 a.m. By 7, he had already left again. Yentaltseva had grown close to the family, and she stayed with the girls until Lyudmila's mother arrived from Kaliningrad. She had become accustomed to Putin's stern, dispassionate demeanor, his reserved precision in dealing with the city's business, and his emotionless response when his dog was killed. But now he seemed rattled. I can't say that he was thrown for a loop and totally at a loss and didn't know what to grab onto, she said. That wasn't the case. I just sensed that he was trying to come up with a plan in his head. Lyudmila spent a month at the Military Medical Academy, where they later discovered the fracture at the base of her skull. After she was released, she had to wear a brace for months. Putin's trust rested with those he knew best, many of them from the power organs. These friends would become known as Siloviki, from the word for force, because of their backgrounds in the military or security services. In moments of crisis, these were the men who he knew would serve him selflessly. Putin distrusted almost everyone else. In the case of Lyudmila's injuries, Putin had relied on Igor Sechin, then Shevchenko, and then his new friend at Dresdner Bank, the former Stasi man Matthias Varnig. It was Dresdner that arranged and paid for Lyudmila to receive at a clinic in Bad Homburg, Germany, the necessary medical treatment that Russia's deteriorating healthcare system could not provide. That Putin himself could not afford the cost of treatment abroad seemed to refute the claims of his critics that he, too, was personally enriching himself in Sobchak's administration. Still, he had a quintessentially Russian understanding that assistance, in crisis or not, came through connections, the exchange of favors. He always remembered acts of loyalty, like Varnig's, just as he never forgave betrayals. After Yeltsin's dissolution of the city council following the 1993 crisis, Sobchak's power in Petersburg seemed unassailable. A decree he authored and Yeltsin signed dramatically shifted authority from the council to the mayor's office, as the city prepared to hold elections in March 1994. The decree created a new, smaller legislative body. Instead of 400 members, a new legislative assembly would have only 50. In theory, it was a democratic restructuring of the branches of power. But in reality, Sobchak consolidated his control of almost all of the city's affairs. On March 16th, 4 days before the elections, he restructured the city government, making himself the chairman of the government and eliminating committees that had once reported to the vice mayor, while consolidating others. The chairman of the three most powerful committees, those overseeing finance, international relations, and operations, were promoted, and Vladimir Putin became one of three first deputies of Sobchak's new government, still in charge of foreign economic affairs. The legislative elections were a farce. Sobchak's office wrote the rules without any input or consent from the council members whose body was being restructured. When the polls opened on March 20th, an overwhelming majority of people simply did not bother voting, risking the invalidation of the results since the law required a minimum turnout of 25%. In only half of the 50 districts did turnout meet the threshold. 25 new deputies joined the assembly, but they lacked a quorum and could not function legally. As it was, Sobchak did not seem troubled by the turn of events. He did not schedule a new round of elections to fill the remaining seats until October. Until then, he and his deputies would govern as they saw fit, without legislative oversight. In the 5 years since the city council was first formed, the euphoric expression of popular will through the ballot box had devolved into disgust with the democratic process. Democracy in Russia had taken root in barren soil, and its growth was already stunted. Much of the blame lay with the catastrophic state of the new Russian economy, with the hardships of privatization, the corrupt amassing of wealth, and the surge in criminality that made Petersburg notorious as a swamp of violence and organized crime. The irony was that the man who had led the fight for democracy in Petersburg bore much of the blame. He had so assiduously belittled the council's work that voters no longer cared who served on it. A brilliant orator and terrible manager, Sobchak, in his preoccupation with power and international prestige, had ignored the workaday problems of his city. His instinct to strengthen democracy meant, in his mind, strengthening his own mercurial rule. Not long after the election, blaming the city's increasing crime, he forced the resignation of the city's police chief, Arkady Kramarev, who had defied the coup's leaders in 1991 and saved Sobchak from arrest. Having consolidated control of the city's television network, Sobchak made sure his coverage was adoring and that of his opponents non-existent. After winning the right to host the Goodwill Games, he used a Soviet-era residency requirement, which the Constitutional Court had overturned, to drive unwanted migrant workers out of the city just before the games opened in July 1994. In that way, the Goodwill Games symbolized Sobchak's mayoralty, an improbable project to boost the city's prestige, undercut by the harsh realities of the country's halting transition. Having failed to turn Petersburg into a world banking capital or a thriving free economic zone, Sobchak believed that playing host to an international sporting event would by itself attract investors who were increasingly shying away. The city, though, was ill-prepared, short on cash, hotels, and sporting facilities. After draining money from the city's subway repair budget and pleading for more money from Moscow, Sobchak's office rushed to renovate the venues, pave roads, and polish up the facades of many of the city's palaces, churches, and monuments. By the time they began, the games were plagued by poor planning, logistical problems, and shoddy work. The indoor arena for ice skating, Turner's Games' mixed winter and summer sports, failed to ice over, and the swimming events had to be postponed for a day because the water in the pool turned brackish when a filter failed. Even then, a greenish hue caused some swimmers to pull out. Ticket prices were beyond the means of ordinary Russians, leaving many events sparsely attended, even when tickets were given away. The city and state invested $70 million in the games, and for most residents, the expense paid for little more than a Potemkin village, impressive to look at, perhaps, but really a facade concealing the city's woeful decay. Sobchak's ambitions nevertheless emerged unchecked. He considered the games a rehearsal for the city's improbable bid to host the Summer Olympics of 2004. In the new Russia, as in the Soviet Union, the desire to hold the Olympics became an obsession directly proportional to the longing for international recognition, for legitimacy at home and abroad. The boycott of the Summer Games in 1980 had left an enduring bitterness that could only be forgotten when a great leader of the nation could once again bring the Olympics back. Sobchak would not be that leader. He was no longer even mayor when, in 1997, the International Olympic Committee selected Athens as the 2004 host, having dropped St. Petersburg's bid, hastily prepared with Putin's help, before it reached the final round of consideration. Sobchak's hubris had blinded him to the most fundamental feature of the democracy he so eloquently promoted. The people have a vote. In 1996, Sobchak was up for re-election, and for Putin, the result represented a profound personal betrayal. Sobchak thought his re-election campaign would be simple. He would remind voters of his heroic leadership during the crises of 1991 and 1993, of the Goodwill Games and the bid for the Olympic Games for 2004, of the new businesses, the banks, the foreign investment, and his own meetings with foreign leaders, including, at the height of the campaign, President Bill Clinton. Sobchak proclaimed himself a Democrat and statesman who stood in the way of the revanchists who would turn Petersburg back into Leningrad. In fact, the communists were the least of his worries. His election was not a test of competing ideologies, but rather a referendum on his mayoralty, and he failed to see that the gravest threat came from within. To coincide with the national presidential election, the city's legislative assembly set the date of the election for June 16th and changed the name of the position from mayor to governor, as it had been when the city's leaders served at the pleasure of the czars. Sobchak's campaign posters showed him sitting behind a desk with the simple slogan, "From mayor to governor," as if it were an inevitable transition. Even he thought the poster was insipid. My campaign headquarters, unfortunately, was much less effective and efficient. By now, Sobchak had less faith in his deputy's political guile and left him to run the city's affairs. But even Putin sensed that Sobchak's political instincts and oratorical flair would no longer be enough to ensure victory. In the national parliamentary elections in December 1995, the party that Sobchak backed had fared poorly, even in Petersburg. Sobchak also underestimated his loss of support in Moscow, where his political ambitions were viewed as a threat among those conspiring to keep Boris Yeltsin in power as the presidential election of 1996 loomed. With the support of Yeltsin's influential chief of security, Russia's prosecutor general Yuri Skuratov had even launched an investigation into Sobchak's affairs at the end of 1995 that appeared intended to curb his political aspirations. It was a reversal of fortune as sudden and arbitrary as a Stalin purge, and it succeeded in sullying Sobchak's image. Skuratov formed an investigative committee that soon began to leak compromising details, known in Russian as kompromat, about the murky privatization of apartments by a company called Renaissance, including ones that went to Putin and other deputies. Putin saw the investigation as a raw use of prosecutorial power against the man he served, and the experience left him with a thirst for revenge. "You know you're on a completely different playing field," Putin recalled telling Sobchak. "You need specialists." Sobchak agreed and turned to Alexander Yuryev, a political scientist at St. Petersburg State University, who warned him that his accomplishments, however great, no longer resonated with a weary electorate disillusioned with the crime and chaos that roiled the city. In January, only a few days after agreeing to work for the campaign, Yuryev answered a knock at the door of his apartment. A pretty young woman stood there, and assuming she was a student delivering an assignment, he opened the door. Only then did he see a man in a mask who hurled a vial of acid in his face. As Yuryev staggered back, the man fired a pistol, though he missed. When Sobchak visited him in the hospital, Yuryev's head was covered in white bandages. The police never found the attackers or established a motive, but Sobchak had no doubt the attempt was part of a vast, unfolding conspiracy to keep him from office. The attack heightened tension so much that Putin began to carry an air pistol, which his old friend Sergei Roldugin noticed when he visited his dacha around the beginning of the campaign. "Do you think an air gun is going to save you?" Roldugin asked him. "It won't save me," he replied, "but it makes me feel calmer." 14 candidates ultimately qualified to challenge Sobchak, and they included some of his bitter personal enemies. the vice mayor, Vyacheslav Shcherbakov, whose dismissal after the 1993 events was still being contested in court, Yuri Shutov, a former aide turned unauthorized Sobchak biographer, and Alexander Belyayev, the former chairman of the city council Sobchak had disbanded. The man Sobchak worried about most, though, was Yuri Boldarev, a prominent liberal who served as the head of the auditing authority in Moscow. It was Boldarev who had investigated the first corruption accusations against Putin in 1992, and he had developed a reputation as a reasonably honest investigator at a time of staggering criminality. Sobchak was already under investigation, and Boldarev's election would almost certainly compound Sobchak's legal troubles, and possibly Putin's as well. Sobchak tried to use lawyerly maneuvers to manipulate the race to his own advantage. In March, he amended the election law to include a residency requirement that would have excluded Boldarev, a native of the city, on the grounds that he had been living and working in Moscow. It was a transparently desperate and undemocratic ploy, which Boldarev successfully fought in court. Sobchak's next gambit proved to have more serious consequences. Although the date of the election was already set for June, Sobchak changed it. He claimed he did so at the insistence of Yeltsin, who had decreed that no other election except the mayor's race in Moscow should be held on the same day as the presidential election. He initially suggested postponing the election until December, but his opponents fiercely denounced this as a naked attempt to extend his term. Instead, he sent Putin to the Legislative Assembly in March to cajole the deputies. Promising jobs and threatening retaliation, Putin eventually pushed through legislation to hold the election on May 19th, but only after mustering a highly suspect quorum. Sobchak's challengers howled in protest. Not only was it a waste of city resources to hold separate elections, but the move cut short the time for them to make their cases with voters. The television networks controlled by Sobchak's office did not help either, lavishing attention on Sobchak while limiting his opponents each to a 15-minute program on air. The risk that Sobchak and Putin failed to consider was that holding the election before the presidential vote would almost certainly lower turnout and hurt his chances, as Yuriev had warned him. Sobchak became uneasy. He suspected that his enemies in Moscow were conspiring against him. He even flew to Moscow in March to appeal to Yeltsin for support, but instead found their friendship had dissipated. Yeltsin's own prospects for re-election that year were abysmal, and he and his aides feared challenges from all sides, real and imagined. It seems one of Yeltsin's deputy prime ministers, Alex Soskovets, had told him that Sobchak, during a meeting with the German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, had expressed a preference for replacing Yeltsin with Viktor Chernomyrdin. Sobchak's paranoia was not misplaced. Within days of Sobchak's meeting in the Kremlin, the extent of the political intrigue against him became clear. Soskovets and Yeltsin's powerful chief of security, Lieutenant General Alexander Korshakov, did have their own candidate in mind to challenge Sobchak in Petersburg. It was not one of the many already in the race, but Sobchak's own deputy, Vladimir Yakovlev. They had been secretly cultivating him for months, even as the prosecutors sharpened their investigations against Sobchak and his staff. On March 27th, Yakovlev unexpectedly announced he was entering the campaign against his own boss. Yakovlev, who at 52 was 7 years younger than Sobchak, was a construction engineer, a former party apparatchik who had made the transition to the new democracy, like Vladimir Putin, under Sobchak's tutelage. He had remained a loyal communist until the party was banned in 1991, even though in 1982 he had been fired from a regional executive committee for using his post to buy a car for his personal use. He was working as chief engineer for a housing construction company when Sobchak hired him in October 1993. A year later, he joined Putin and Alexei Kudrin as first deputy mayors. Yakovlev had no more of a public profile than Putin, but he had more ambition and less loyalty, and he accepted the support Korshakov and Soskovets promised to oust his own boss. The announcement shocked Sobchak, who promptly fired Yakovlev. If Yakovlev had been man enough, he said, he would have resigned before announcing his challenge. Yakovlev's candidacy also infuriated Putin. He publicly called Yakovlev a Judas and circulated a letter for all of Sobchak's employees to sign, declaring that they would resign in protest if Sobchak lost the election. With the bitterness of hindsight, Sobchak described Yakovlev's accomplishments as modest. He was not as intelligent as the more educated, cultural, and skilled people on his team, like Putin. The staff disparaged him with the nickname the Plumber, a telling contrast to Putin's Stasi. Sobchak ignored Yakovlev along with the rest of his challengers and carried on with his official duties as if that alone would prove his electoral worthiness. He campaigned more intently for Yeltsin before the presidential election as well, hoping to prove his loyalty and restore the political alliance they had once had. On April 19th, Bill Clinton arrived in Petersburg on his way to meetings in Moscow that the Americans, too, hoped would help Yeltsin beat back a challenge from the resurgent Communist Party. Sobchak met him at the airport and rode with him in the limousine to Tsarskoye Selo, the imperial estate south of the city. Perhaps mindful that his private conversations had a way of getting back to Yeltsin, Sobchak went out of his way to explain how Yeltsin would triumph over his main challenger, the communist Gennady Zhuganov. Sobchak shadowed Clinton everywhere, relishing his appearance on television as a statesman in the company of a world leader. Clinton, though, complained that he had been kept in a goddamn cocoon during his trip. A meeting with students at the Hermitage had been canceled, his request to stop the motorcade to shake hands in the street rebuffed. Clinton's aide, Strobe Talbot, blamed the overzealousness of the official who oversaw the details of the visit, Vladimir Putin, though he added that at the time the name meant nothing to any of us. Yakovlev was not the natural politician Sobchak was, but he was charismatic in his own way and far more attuned to voters' desires. Tall and thin, he had a cherubic face with wide cheekbones prone to split into a goofy grin. He offered no real ideological alternative. He had no intention of reversing privatization of apartments or factories, for example, but promised that he would try to fix the city's myriad problems: undrinkable tap water, potholed streets, crumbling subways. He promised jobs, not the Olympics. Sobchak belittled his campaign promises as bewitching fantasies for a gullible public, but he grossly underestimated his aide's appeal. In a city where people still lived in communal apartments, where basic services like ambulances were meager, the water was tainted with giardia, and sewage flowed untreated into the Baltic Sea, where for a month in September 1995, the city could not even heat its hospitals, perhaps a plumber was just what voters wanted. With an infusion of cash from his backers in Moscow, Yakovlev turned to professional campaign consultants, who helped him run a far more organized and effective campaign that filled mailboxes with leaflets, the airwaves with advertisements, all with the same simple message of restoring basic governance and services. Yakovlev also had political support from a potent new ally, Yuri Lushkov, the bald-headed, barrel-chested populist mayor of Moscow. Yakovlev fashioned himself as a Lushkov for Petersburg, and Lushkov publicly suggested new projects that would make both cities prosper. Sobchak's campaign, by contrast, ran out of money. Having played little role to this point, Putin now entered the fray, pleading for donations from the businessmen he had been working with for the past 5 years, something he viewed with undisguised disgust. When he invited a group of them to a fundraiser, however, they refused to help. The very people who, in his view, had profited from the privatizations and investments that he and Sobchak had made possible. A local mobster had better luck, raising $2,000 each from small businessmen who thought better than to refuse a donation to the Foundation for the Support of the Mayor. Sobchak's dominance of the city's politics since 1989, his charisma and prestige, no longer shielded him from withering personal attacks. Alexander Belyayev, the former council chairman, told a press conference that Sobchak and Putin owned property on the Atlantic coast of France. He said that Sobchak had been detained in 1993 at Heathrow Airport in London, carrying a suitcase of $1 million in cash. He vowed that when he became governor, Sobchak will be sitting in jail. Putin responded to the accusations against him by filing a lawsuit accusing Belyayev of slander. But he filed it in the wrong jurisdiction and was mercilessly mocked in the press. "An intelligence agent should know where his defendant lives," said one newspaper headline. Putin tried to defend himself, claiming he did not even know where the Atlantic coast of France was, which only intensified the public mockery. The campaign was wild, and it was dirty. It also was more or less free and fair. Elections in Russia could be riotous then, but they were democratic. When the ballots were counted on the night of May 19th, Sobchak came out on top of the 13 other candidates, but he received only 28% of the vote to Yakovlev's 21%. Since neither had accumulated 50%, a runoff was scheduled for June 2nd. Sobchak still hoped to prevail, but panic now gripped his campaign team and his staff. Putin became noticeably more nervous and threw himself even more directly into the campaign. But by then, it was hopeless. Sobchak's vanquished opponents all endorsed Yakovlev. Worse, the investigations circling around Sobchak's finances and the apartments he distributed spilled into the public, confirmed by one of the local investigators, Leonid Proshkin. The news of the accusations was printed on flyers and distributed all over the city by Yakovlev's campaign. In one instance, they were dropped from a helicopter. Putin, indignant, wrote a letter to Yeltsin, Chernomyrdin, and the prosecutor general, Yuri Skuratov, whom he accused directly of engaging in a campaign of persecution and slander. Proshkin, he fulminated, gave an interview in violation of all procedural norms to pro-communist newspapers and thus spread unsubstantiated material. Putin demanded decisive action to end the use of the law enforcement authorities for political purposes. The last 2 weeks of the election were fraught with tension as both campaigns slung mud. Yakovlev, worried about his own safety, rode around the city with two SUVs full of rifle-toting guards dressed in black. He confronted Putin with rumors that Sobchak had ordered his assassination. "What are you, crazy?" Putin replied. "You had better go look at yourself in the mirror." Sobchak's last hope was a televised debate in the last week before the vote, but there his eloquence failed him. Yakovlev seemed at ease. He took off his jacket and spoke clearly and forcefully. Sobchak, sitting hunched in his suit, stammered and struggled for words. He had a fever before the debate, he later recounted, and felt his tongue thicken when it started. Spasms wrenched his throat. When asked about the suspicious provenance of a dacha, Sobchak could not answer. Only later, he said, did he learn the truth. Yakovlev's campaign team had brought a psychic into the audience. "I consulted experts, and they confirmed to me that a strong hypnotic effect often causes spasms in the throat, a heavy tongue, headache, and a sharp rise in body temperature, owing to the body's resistance to the influence of alien energy." Sobchak was not just losing the election, he seemed to be losing his mind. In the end, Yakovlev won with 47.5% of the vote. Sobchak received 45.8%. He was less than gracious in defeat. Never known for modesty, he compared his fate to Winston Churchill's, the savior of the country, the symbol of victory, who was ousted at the ballot box in 1945. He petulantly refused to attend Yakovlev's inauguration, held at Smolny 10 days later. And yet Sobchak, for all his authoritarian tendencies, did what no other elected official of such prominence had done in Russia. He did not contest the results or otherwise try to block Yakovlev's victory. He accepted defeat and stepped down. I was not an addict to power, like Lenin or Yeltsin, and had I lost the election to a worthy opponent, the defeat would have been easier to accept, he wrote in a memoir he titled tellingly, A Dozen Knives in the Back. But in this case, it preoccupied me that I could lose to this obviously gray and primitive man, Yakovlev. I cursed myself that I failed to see it, the stealing from the government for private engineering offices. But what hurt the most was the apostasy or direct betrayal on the part of many of those who surrounded me. He noted one exception, Vladimir Putin. Sobchak's unexpected loss left Putin without a job, without a patron, and without a purpose. It was like his return from East Germany all over again. Despite the letter he and others had signed, he did not immediately resign, even though now he served at the pleasure of a new governor he had called a Judas. Yakovlev persuaded other Sobchak aides to stay on, including Dmitry Kozak, a former prosecutor and friend, and Mikhail Manevich, a young economist, who became a deputy governor. Kozak would remain close to Putin for years, but Manevich was assassinated a year later by a sniper who fired 8 bullets into his car as it turned onto Nevsky Prospect. Putin remained in his office at Smolny through Yeltsin's unexpected re-election in the summer of 1996, but then was asked, rather harshly, to clear out by the end of June. The new governor had not forgotten Putin's coldness and his comments during the campaign. When an aide told him Putin was still waiting for word on his fate, Yakovlev's face reddened. "I don't want to hear anything more about that asshole," he said. Sobchak tried to help his loyal deputy land a new job, even appealing to Yevgeny Primakov, an old spymaster who had headed the successor of the KGB's foreign intelligence branch until he was appointed Yeltsin's foreign minister in January 1996. "You'll be an ambassador," his former boss told Putin. It was too ridiculous to contemplate, and Putin knew it, though he could not bring himself to tell Sobchak. Others promised him he would be needed somewhere, but nothing materialized immediately. In July, he moved his family to a dacha he had built on the shore of Lake Komsomolskaya, 70 miles north of the city on the Karelian Isthmus, a part of Finland until the Soviet Union incorporated it after the Great Patriotic War. A small village was nearby. There, Putin joined a handful of the businessmen he had befriended since 1991 in carving out what would become a gated community on the lake's shore, incorporated later that year under the name Ozera, or Lake. The shareholders included Vladimir Yankunin, Yuri Kovalchuk, and the brothers Forsenko, Andrei and Sergei. All had met through their work at the highly regarded IOFI Physical Technical Institute in Petersburg. They founded an enterprise to turn their scientific work into commercially viable products with the help of Putin's Committee for Foreign Economic Affairs. Yakunin and Kovalchuk became shareholders in a financial institution, Bank Russia, which had been created in 1990 to handle the accounts of the Communist Party and, as was widely rumored, the KGB. The bank had become a shell by the time Kovalchuk and his colleagues took it over, and it only survived because Putin steered the government's accounts to it. Another of Bank Russia's shareholders and executives, Viktor Myachin, also joined the dacha community, as did Nikolai Shamalov, who had been one of Putin's deputies on the Committee for Foreign Economic Affairs until he became the representative in northeastern Russia for the German manufacturer Siemens. Putin was the lone government official among these new businessmen, and it was never exactly clear how his meager salary covered the costs, though evidence would later surface that it came from 20th Trust, an organization Putin's committee had registered in 1992. The company's activities, including numerous contracts from the city that bore Putin's signature, were among those that had drawn the attention of the investigators dispatched from Moscow to look into Sobchak's administration. Putin's house on the property was made of red brick, paneled with wood inside. It had 2 stories with an expansive view of the lake. Its size, only 1,600 square feet in all, was relatively modest, but it was on the lake shore, isolated by the woods, a place where he could contemplate his suddenly uncertain future. Had Sobchak won the election, Putin certainly would have stayed at his side, but he had nurtured ties to no other politicians. He considered becoming a lawyer. He talked to an old judo partner, Vasily Shestakov, about working as a trainer at his club. Shestakov told him it was beneath him now, but if nothing else materialized, he could come. It was a hard fall. He brooded, refusing to discuss his uncertain fate with Lyudmila. Whenever he sank into a funk, she knew it was best to leave him alone. Her husband was one of those who does not love to lose, and the campaign gave him a bitter taste of the risk inherent in true democracy. True, he never talked about it or even let on, Lyudmila said, but I understood everything, felt it, saw it. August is a leisurely month in Russia, a season of late summer languor when most of the country retreats to their dachas. Having failed to find a new job immediately, Putin would have to wait until official business resumed in earnest at the end of August before he could seriously look again. On August 12th, the Putins invited his former secretary, Marina Yantaltseva, her husband, and their daughter to visit the dacha. In the evening, the men retreated to the banya on the first floor, just inside the door. Putin called it a wake for my former job. He had just returned from a cooling plunge in the lake when he saw smoke. A heater inside the banya sparked a fire that soon spread through the house. Katya bolted out from the kitchen. Putin found his older daughter, Masha, and Marina on the second floor, and as flames climbed the stairs, he lowered them from a balcony using sheets as a rope. He suddenly remembered that he had a briefcase in his bedroom with his money, some $5,000. With the lights out and smoke choking the house, he felt around for the briefcase. Wrapped only in a thin sheet, he climbed from the balcony and, with his family and neighbors, watched the house burn like a candle. Firefighters arrived, but they could do nothing because the truck had no water. "There's a whole lake right here," Putin shouted. True, one told him, but they had no hose either. Vasily Shestakov marveled when he heard the news of the fire and the rescue of Putin's cash. Not only had Putin not built some opulent stone mansion, but in 5 years, as the second man in the city, he had not amassed a fortune greater than $5,000. Such was the presumption of corruption among Russia's apparatchiks that Putin could have stolen recklessly without much fear of being singled out. The fire inspectors determined that the builders had improperly installed the banya's heater, and Putin forced them to rebuild it as it was, minus the banya. When workers cleared the debris, they found in the ashes the aluminum cross his mother had given him when he and Sobchak traveled to Jerusalem 3 years before. He had taken it off while they steamed in the banya, and in the confusion of the fire, forgotten about it. He considered it a revelation, and later sometimes claimed that he never removed it.